Great offense, in economic terms, means that a household generates an income significantly higher than the norm, which in America is an annual realized income of approximately $33,000. Most of these households also play great defense. That is, they are frugal when it comes to spending for consumer goods and services. One frugal high-income producer within the married couple category, however, does not automatically translate into a high level of net worth. Something else must be present. A self-made millionaire stated it best when he told us, "I can't get my wife to spend any money." Most people will never become wealthy in one generation if they are married to people who are wasteful. A couple cannot accumulate wealth if one of its members is a hyper-consumer. This is especially true when one or both are trying to build a successful business. Few people can sustain profligate spending habits and simultaneously build wealth. Ode to his frugal wife. How did the wife of a millionaire respond when her husband gave her $8 million worth of stock in the company he recently took public? According to her husband of 31 years, she said, "I appreciate this. I really do." Then she smiled, never changing her position at the kitchen table, where she continued to cut out 25 and 50 cents off food coupons from the week's supply of newspapers. Nothing is so important as to interrupt her Saturday morning chores. She just does today like she always has done, even when all we owned was a kitchen table. It's how come we're well off today. Made a lot of trade-offs, sacrifices early in our marriage. Why aren't you wealthy, you ask? Well, let's examine your lifestyle. Is it one of great offense? Are you in the $70,000, $100,000, $200,000 income category? Congratulations, you play wonderful offense. But how is it that you keep losing the game called wealth accumulation? Be honest with yourself. Could it be that you play terrible defense? Most high-income earners are in the same situation, but not most millionaires. Millionaires play both quality offense and quality defense, and quite often their great defense helps them outscore or out-accumulate those who out-earn or have superior offenses. The foundation stone of wealth accumulation is defense, and this defense should be anchored by budgeting and planning. We have discovered that several occupational groups contain large numbers of budgeters and planners. Affluent auctioneers. Our latest survey of auctioneers found that more than 35% of them are millionaires. This percentage is slightly higher than the proportion of millionaire households living in America's finest urban and suburban neighborhoods. Auctioneers have been on our list of highly productive types since we conducted our first study of occupations in 1983, when they ranked sixth among those with realized annual incomes of more than $100,000. But their income alone was not what caught our attention. Given the same level of income, who accumulates more wealth? An auctioneer residing in small-town America, or someone who lives in a high-status urban or suburban neighborhood? As you can guess, it is the typical auctioneer. Auctioneers are more frugal than their high-income-producing counterparts in prestige areas. They have lower overhead both for household and business expenditures. To some extent, these data are explained by the lower cost of living and doing business in small towns. Yet even when cost of living is taken into account, auctioneers are more prone to accumulate wealth. Consider the following. On average, millionaire auctioneers are about 50 years of age, 6 to 8 years younger than their urban or suburban counterparts. The average millionaire auctioneer spends only 61% of the amount urban or suburban millionaires allocate for housing. Urban or suburban millionaires are more than 3 times more likely than millionaire auctioneers to own luxury foreign automobiles. Auctioneers hold a higher proportion of their wealth in appreciating assets than do other high-income producers, and they invest in categories in which they have expertise. Auctioneers have experience with bankruptcy. They are aware that consumer goods often generate few cents on the dollar. One auctioneer explained why she was so frugal. "When I was quite young, I watched a woman crying, sitting on a chair in her front yard. All the while, bidders were walking away with everything she once owned. I'll never forget that woman." Let's ask the typical American self-made millionaire about her defense. We will refer to her as Mrs. Jane Rule. Mrs. Rule and her husband own a small business, an auctioneering and appraising company. They also invest in several of the categories of items they appraise. Mr. Rule is the visible manager of their business. He gets much of the credit for its success. After all, he speaks very well and very quickly. But it's actually Mrs. Rule who is the true force, the real leader of this enterprise. It's her planning, designing, budgeting, bill collecting, and marketing that made this auctioneering company successful. Why are Mr. and Mrs. Rule millionaires today? Because Mrs. Rule plays tremendous defense. She is responsible for budgeting and spending for both her household and their business. Is anyone in your household responsible for budgeting? All too often the answer is, not really. All too often people allow their income to define their budgets. When we tell our audiences about the budgeting and planning habits of the affluent, someone always asks a predictable question. Why would someone who is a millionaire need to budget? Our answer is always the same. They became millionaires by budgeting and controlling expenses, and they maintain their affluent status the same way. Sometimes we are forced to add analogies to make our point. We ask, for example, have you ever noticed those people whom you see jogging day after day? They are the ones who seem not to need to jog, but that's why they are fit. Those who are wealthy work at staying financially fit. But those who are not financially fit do little to change their status. Most people want to be physically fit, and the majority know what is required to achieve this. But despite that knowledge, most people never become well-conditioned physically. Why not? Because they don't have the discipline to just do it. They don't budget their time to just do it. It is like becoming wealthy in America. Oh, you want to, all right, but you play lousy financial defense. You don't have the discipline to control your spending. You don't take the time to budget or plan. Note that under-accumulators of wealth spend 3 times as much time exercising per month as they do planning their investment strategies. Mrs. Rule is different. She's like most millionaires. She's disciplined. She takes time to plan and budget. This translates into wealth. Mrs. Rule's household income varies from year to year. It is typical for auctioneers to have ups and downs in their cash flow. Often, downturns in our nation's economy translate into increased demand for auctioneering services. Over the past 5 years, her annual income averaged around $90,000. But her net worth keeps increasing. Today, Mrs. Rule has a net worth of more than $2 million. In our survey, she answered yes to 4 questions about planning and budgeting. Do you wish to become affluent and stay affluent? Can you answer yes, candidly and honestly, to these 4 simple questions? Question 1. Does your household operate on an annual budget? Do you plan your consumption spending according to a variety of food, clothing, and shelter categories each year? Mrs. Rule does, and so do most millionaires. In fact, in our latest national survey of millionaires, we found that for every 100 millionaires who don't budget, there are about 120 who do. We anticipate your question about these millionaires who don't budget. How did they become millionaires? How do they control spending? They create an artificial economic environment of scarcity for themselves and the other members of their household. More than half of the non-budgeters invest first and spend the balance of their income. Many call this the pay-yourself-first strategy. These people invest a minimum of 15% of their annual realized income before they pay the sellers of their food, clothes, homes, credit, and the like. What about those millionaires who don't budget or create an environment of relative scarcity? Some inherited all or most of their wealth. Another minority, accounting for fewer than 20% of millionaires, typically earn such high incomes that to some extent they can eat their income and still have a 7-figure net worth. In other words, their extraordinarily good offense compensates for a lack of defense. But so what if you earn $2 million a year and have a net worth of $1 million? Technically, you're a millionaire, but spiritually, you're an under-accumulator of wealth. And it's likely that your millionaire status is temporary. These are the people you read about in the newspaper. The press loves to tout freaks of both nature and economics. Will the popular press ever do a story on Mrs. Rule? It's unlikely. Who wants to read about Mrs. Rule's $140,000 home or her 4-year-old Detroit metal sedan? Who wants to see her sitting at the kitchen table 3 nights in a row putting together her family's annual budget? Is there anything exciting about computing and accounting for each dollar spent last year? Would you be thrilled to watch Mrs. Rule compute and allocate future dollars of income into dozens of consumption categories? How long could you stand to watch her carefully complete her annual allocations calendar? Well, it's not fun for Mrs. Rule either. But in Mrs. Rule's mind, there are worse things, such as never being able to retire and never being financially independent. It's much easier to budget if you visualize the long-term benefits of this task. Question 2. Do you know how much your family spends each year for food, clothing, and shelter? Almost 2/3 of the millionaires surveyed, 62.4%, answered yes to this question. So did Mrs. Rule. But only about 35% of high-income producing non-millionaires answered yes to this question. Many of these high-income, low-net-worth types have no idea how much they spend each year for such items as food consumed at home, food consumed away from home, beverages, birthday and holiday gifts, each category of clothing for each household member at each store, babysitters, daycare fees, line of credit use, charitable contributions, financial advice, club dues, motor vehicles and related expenses, tuition, vacations, heating and lighting, and insurance. Notice that we did not include mortgage payments in our list. Often, high-income, low-net-worth respondents boast about how much money they save on taxes via their mortgage deductions. Certainly, most millionaires who have mortgages outstanding also take advantage of this provision. But most millionaires also account for their other categories of domestic expenditures. Ask typical high-income, low-net-worth people about their goals. What will they tell you? A major goal they often name is to minimize their tax burden. They use the mortgage deduction as a way to accomplish this. Then why don't these same people compute their other domestic expenditures? Simply because they do not perceive any value in doing so. As they see it, most of their domestic spending is not deductible in computing one's taxable income. But Mrs. Rule sees things differently. Her goal is to become financially independent. In her case, to have $5 million by the time she and her husband retire. She believes that budgeting and accounting for domestic consumption is directly related to achieving this goal. In her view, tabulating helps control consumption. It also reduces the probability of allocating too many dollars to product and service categories that are not really important. Mrs. Rule has always tabulated expenditures for her business. She realizes that the same system she used for business accounting can be used for domestic purposes. This is an advantage of being a self-employed business owner. Mrs. Rule wants to be free of financial worry before her 65th birthday. Each time she tabulates, she tells herself she is reducing her fear of never being able to retire in comfort. Who has concern about their financial future? Not Mrs. Rule. Although she has an annual income of $90,000, she's worth more than 20 times that amount. And she is in control of her household's domestic spending. Robert and Judy, on the other hand, are frightened. And they should be. This couple earns $200,000 annually, or more than twice what Mrs. Rule earns. Yet, like so many of today's high-income producing couples, Robert and Judy have only a fraction of Mrs. Rule's wealth. They feel that consumption controls them, not the other way around. Even Mrs. Rule might find it daunting to have to account for $200,000 in expenditures each year. Robert and Judy have 14 credit cards. The Rules have 2, one for business use, the other for domestic spending. Let's talk about credit cards for a moment. Ask a large sample of millionaires a simple question about their credit cards. The results will give you an excellent idea of who these millionaires really are. Mr. or Mrs. Millionaire, please indicate by circling the appropriate number the credit cards that you or any member of your house possesses. Circle all of those that apply. Now close your eyes and pretend you're a millionaire with a net worth of nearly $4 million. What credit cards would be congruent with your station in life? Perhaps at the top of your list would be American Express Platinum, Diners Club, or Carte Blanche. Perhaps you consider yourself a fashion-sensitive millionaire. You may list credit cards from Brooks Brothers, Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, Lord & Taylor, or even Eddie Bauer. You would be in the minority of millionaires if you did list these cards. The results from our national survey of millionaires reveal some interesting credit card preferences. Some highlights. Like most American households, most wealthy households have a MasterCard and a Visa card. The millionaire household is 4 times more likely to hold a Sears card, 43%, than a Brooks Brothers card, 10%. Both Sears and Penney's cards are significantly more popular among the wealthy than the cards of status retailers. Only 21% of the wealthy households in America hold the Neiman Marcus card, 25% Saks Fifth Avenue, 25% Lord & Taylor, and only 8.1% the Eddie Bauer card. Only 6.2% of the millionaire respondents hold the American Express Platinum card, 3.4% hold Diners Club, and fewer than 1% own Carte Blanche. Question 3. Do you have a clearly defined set of daily, weekly, monthly, annual, and lifetime goals? The source of this question came from a decamillionaire whom we interviewed a dozen years ago. He told us that he started a wholesale food business at the age of 19. He never finished formal high school, but did eventually receive his high school equivalency diploma. We asked him to account for the fact that, although he was a high school dropout, he had accumulated over $10 million. His response was as follows. I have always been goal-oriented. I have a clearly defined set of daily goals, weekly goals, monthly goals, annual goals, and lifetime goals. I even have goals to go to the bathroom. I always tell our young executives that they must have goals. Mrs. Rule is goal-oriented. So are most other millionaires. For every 100 millionaires who answered no to this question, there are 180 who answered yes. Who are the no's? Many of the high-income and inherited wealth types discussed in the last section. Many senior citizens and retired millionaires who have already reached most of their goals also answered no. You may wish to reflect for a moment on the comments made by an 80-year-old multimillionaire. The first question we always ask is about goals. What are your current goals? Mr. Clark responded, "It was $438 an ounce yesterday in London." After Mr. Clark turned on his hearing aid, we repeated the question. "Oh, goals, not gold. I see, my goals. I've accomplished what I've tried to do. My long-range goal was, of course, to accumulate enough wealth so I can get out of business and enjoy life. I've been down the road. I've got an international reputation. Mine is one of the greatest welding companies in the world. I never want to retire, but now my goal is my family and self-satisfaction about what I've accomplished." Mr. Clark is typical of seniors who have accumulated significant wealth. By the way, only 2 millionaires of all those we interviewed ever told us that their goal was to spend my last dollar the day that I die. Neither Mr. Clark nor Mrs. Rule has such a goal. Mrs. Rule plans to leave educational trusts for all of her grandchildren. She also wants to enjoy life now and after she retires. She wants to be financially secure. Her financial goal is to accumulate $5 million. Mrs. Rule knows how much she needs to set aside each year to attain her goals. But is she happy? That's a question very often asked of us regarding frugal millionaires. Yes, she is happy. She is financially secure. Mrs. Rule enjoys being part of a close-knit family. Her family is everything to her. Her life and her goals are simple. Mrs. Rule does not need a CPA to do her goal planning for her, although she does seek his counsel in regard to both her domestic and business-related needs. But Robert and Judy, our high-income, low-net-worth couple, are in dire need of a strong and intelligent guiding hand. They need a CPA who has considerable experience in changing his clients' orientations, one who will help them change their household environment from one of chaos and hyper-consumption to one of goal-oriented planning, budgeting, and controlling. Will they then be happy? We don't know, but we can tell you this. Financially independent people are happier than those in their same income/age cohort who are not financially secure. Financially independent people seem to be better able to visualize the future benefits of defining their goals. Mrs. Rule, for instance, visualizes all her grandchildren graduating from college. She visualizes their success after college. She never sees herself being financially dependent on others, even if she is disabled in the future. Her goals are congruent with those of most millionaires in this regard. Question 4. Do you spend a lot of time planning your financial future? For every 100 millionaires who answer no, there are 192 who answer yes. Again, many who answer no are either high-income types with relatively low levels of accumulated wealth, those who inherited all or most of their wealth, or wealthy seniors or retirees. People such as Mrs. Rule accurately label themselves as planners. In fact, the responses to this question are highly correlated to the actual hours the respondents allocate to planning their financial futures. On average, millionaires spend significantly more hours per month studying and planning their future investment decisions, as well as managing their current investments, than high-income non-millionaires. The hours allocated to planning and managing finances will be detailed later. Millionaires like Mrs. Rule not only spend more time planning their finances than non-millionaires, they also seem to get more out of their planning hours. Remember, Mrs. Rule is not only in the auctioneering business. Her job includes appraising the value of what her company auctions. Often, Mrs. Rule invests in those same areas in which she has considerable expertise. In this regard, she is like many millionaires. They astutely allocate their time so that they can plan their business and personal investing at the same time. We often find that highly productive auctioneers are also excellent investors. Take, for example, an auctioneer who specializes in auctioning commercial real estate. What area of investments does he know a great deal about? Commercial real estate. He is his own investment analyst. What if your auctioneering specialty is antique furniture and American firearms? Should you invest in high-tech securities? Probably not. But you would be wise to use your expertise to help you make your investments. If you're well-versed in antiques, why not leverage your knowledge? You don't have to be an auctioneer to benefit from your knowledge. One of our associates was formerly the head of strategic planning at a major corporation. Part of his job was to study a wide variety of trends across a wide variety of business categories. Years ago, he discovered that the demand for investment-grade baseball cards would likely explode someday. This was long before the market reflected this trend. He invested heavily when the market was asleep, in his words. And he sold out all his holdings, including all his Mickey Mantle rookie cards, at the top of the market. Another acquaintance, a manager of a department store, always studied trade journals to learn how to make his store more productive. Later, he leveraged his reading habits into investing in growth stocks in the retailing area. How much time do non-millionaires allocate to planning and managing? Not enough. As previously stated, much less than millionaires. Although millionaires have much more experience in making investment decisions, they allocate significantly more hours than do non-millionaires in an effort to become even better investors. That is one of the main reasons that millionaires remain wealthy. Business owners like Mrs. Rule certainly have more freedom than people who are not self-employed. She can and does leverage her business knowledge with her personal investing habits. She can pick her area of business and the one she wants to study. Often employees don't have this luxury. But even among those who do have significant knowledge about excellent investment opportunities, many do not leverage this knowledge. Consider the following examples. A highly productive sales professional, we will call him Mr. Willis, had Walmart as a client for more than 10 years. All during this time, Walmart was exploding in growth and value. How many shares of Walmart did Mr. Willis, the six-figure earning sales professional, ever purchase? Zero. Yes, zero, even though he had considerable first-hand knowledge of his client's success and an annual six-figure income. But he did purchase a foreign luxury car every 2 years during this time. A high-income-producing marketing manager, Mr. Peterson, was employed in the high-tech field. But he never invested a dollar in Microsoft or any other growth company. Never, in spite of having considerable knowledge about many of the firms in the technology industry. The owner of a printing business enjoyed having one of the leading beverage companies in America as a customer. The customer bought millions of dollars worth of printing from him annually. But how much money has the printer invested in his customer's equity offerings? Zero. In all three cases, the person makes a higher income than does Mrs. Rule. Yet none is a millionaire. In fact, Mr. Peterson, the marketing manager, has zero invested in stocks. He never invests any of his income. But he lives in a $400,000 home that is surrounded by others in the high-tech field who have big hats and bigger mortgages, but no cattle. Too many high-income, low-net-worth types live from paycheck to paycheck, fearing a sudden downturn in our economy. Our friend, the UAW. What motivates Theodore Teddy J. Friend? Why does he work so hard? Why is he driven to earn so much money? Why does he spend so much? Teddy will tell you it's because he's competitive. But so are almost all top-producing sales professionals. His competitiveness is not the most important reason for his behavior. When Teddy was growing up, his family was among the poorest in a blue-collar community. His family's small home was built from used lumber and similar discarded materials. Until Teddy was a freshman in high school, his father cut Teddy's hair, which did save money, although, according to Teddy, most people could tell that his head was worked on by an amateur. The public high school he attended attracted students from a wide variety of socioeconomic backgrounds. Many were from upscale homes. Rich kids were there in large enough numbers to fill the high school's parking lot with their nice cars. These cars always amazed Mr. Friend. Throughout high school, his family owned one automobile. It was a well-used Ford that his dad had bought when it was 10 years old. During his high school years, Mr. Friend made a promise to himself that someday he would be a lot better off than his parents. Better off, in his mind, meant having a nice home in an upscale neighborhood, fine clothes for everyone in his family, classy cars, club memberships, and items purchased in the best stores. Mr. Friend realized that better off could be achieved by finding a high-paying position and working very hard. Never did Mr. Friend equate better off with accumulating wealth. Again, being better off meant displaying one's high income via the conspicuous display of high-status artifacts. Teddy never gave much thought to the benefits of building an investment portfolio. To him, a high income was the way to overcome a feeling of social inferiority. A high income was the product of hard work. Income in the form of capital gains were foreign words to him. Mr. Friend's father and mother were dysfunctional when it came to putting money away for a rainy day. Their financial plan was very simple. They spent when they had money. They stopped spending when they ran short of money. If they needed something, such as a washing machine or a new roof, they saved for it. But they also bought many items with installment loans. They never owned any stocks or bonds. Never did Teddy's parents set aside income for investment purposes. They did not understand or trust the stock market. The only real financial wealth the couple had was a small pension and the equity in their very modest home. Today, their son has a need to compensate for his primitive blue-collar background and his perceived educational deficiency. Mr. Friend never completed college. Even now, he feels compelled to outperform all the college graduates against whom he competes. He will tell you that he enjoys dressing better, driving better, dwelling better, and in general, living higher than all those college kids who operate within his territory. Mr. Friend is the ultimate consumer. He has two boats, one jet ski, and six automobiles. Two are leased, the others were purchased via credit. Interestingly, there are only three drivers in his household. He is a member of two country clubs and wears a watch that cost more than $5,000. He buys his clothes from the best stores. Mr. Friend also owns a vacation condo. Last year, Mr. Friend's income was approximately $221,000. Given his age, 48, what is his expected net worth? According to our wealth equation, his net worth should be $1,060,800. Expected wealth equals 1/10 of your age times your total annual income. What is his real net worth? Less than 1/4 of the expected figure. How is it possible that Mr. Friend has an actual net worth that is less than 1/4 of the expected value? The answer lies in how Mr. Friend thinks. Wealth accumulation is not what motivates him. Interestingly, Mr. Friend firmly believes that if he were really wealthy, he would not be a top income generator. He has often stated that people who come from wealthy backgrounds have little motivation to excel in the workplace. Mr. Friend has found a method to sustain and even enhance his drive to perform at high levels. He has found that fear is a great motivator. So he buys more and more via credit. By increasing the amount he owes, he correspondingly increases the accountant's fear of default. In turn, this increasing level of debt-based fear encourages him to work harder and more aggressively. To him, a big home is a reminder of a big mortgage and the need to perform at a high level. Mr. Friend is not a big spender across all categories of products and services. Ask him how much money he allocates for financial advice. In this category, he is very price sensitive. For example, his choice of an accountant was based almost exclusively on the accountant's fees, not on his quality. Mr. Friend has always believed that the quality of service that accountants deliver is about the same, only their fees are different. That's why he picked an accountant who has low fees. In sharp contrast, most wealthy people feel that you get what you pay for in the realm of financial advice. Mr. Friend spends a considerable amount of time working. Still, he constantly worries that he will lose his so-called competitive edge. He is concerned that his need to outperform the rich kids, the college graduates, will wane someday. Mr. Friend constantly reminds himself about his humble background and lack of that all-important college degree. He constantly punishes himself psychologically. In his eyes, he is inferior in pedigree to those very confident college graduates against whom he competes. He often wonders how they can be so content, given their less than exceptional performance in the workplace. Mr. Friend never really enjoys his life. He owns a lot of upscale things, yet he works so hard and for so many hours during a typical day that he has no time to enjoy them. He has no time for his family either. He leaves his house each day before dawn and rarely returns home in time for dinner. Would you like to be Mr. Friend? His lifestyle is appealing to many people. But if these people really understood Mr. Friend's inner workings, they might evaluate him differently. Mr. Friend is possessed by possessions. He works for things. His motivation and his thoughts are focused on the symbols of economic success. He constantly needs to convince others of this success. Unhappily, he has never convinced himself. In essence, he works, he earns, and he sacrifices to impress others. These factors underlie the thought processes of many under-accumulators of wealth. More often than not, UAWs allow significant others to determine their financial lifestyle. Interestingly, these significant others, or reference groups, turn out to be more imagined than real. Are you motivated by significant others? Perhaps you should consider a different approach to life. Perhaps you should reorient yourself. Are all high-income people who came from humble beginnings destined to become UAWs? Will they all turn out to follow the ways of Mr. Friend? Absolutely not. There is a fundamental reason beyond Mr. Friend's perceived social and educational deficiencies that explains why he became a UAW. His parents taught him the ways of the UAW. In spite of their modest income, his parents were not frugal. They spent nearly all their income. They were professionals in expending resources. Any pending increase in income was immediately earmarked for consumption. Even anticipated income tax refunds were allocated for consumption, long before the checks were received. Their consumer behavior had an impact on their son. They constantly sent him a message. One earns to spend. When you need to spend more, you need to earn more. Life among friends. How did Mr. Friend's parents spend their money? He told us that throughout their marriage they ate a lot, smoked a lot, drank a lot, and shopped a lot. Their household was always overloaded with food. They stockpiled snack foods, prime meats, cold cuts, ice creams, and other desserts. Even breakfast was a feast. Bacon, sausage, home fries, eggs, English muffins, and Danish pastries were basics in the morning. Steaks and roasts were the preferred dinner offerings. The friends never skipped a meal. Neighbors and relatives were frequent guests at the friends' restaurant, as they referred to their home. Mr. Friend's parents, between them, smoked about 3 packs of cigarettes a day. During a normal week, they consumed 2 cases of beer. On holidays, consumption of food, tobacco, and alcohol greatly increased. Shopping and consuming were the friends' main hobbies. More often than not, they shopped for fun, not necessity. On most Saturdays, they would shop from the early morning until mid-afternoon. First, they shopped for food. Then they spent countless hours shopping in discount stores. Mr. Friend pointed out that most of the stuff they bought was junk. His mother was an especially aggressive discount store shopper. She had a strong proclivity for purchasing large quantities of throw rugs, ashtrays, malted milk balls, caramel corn, towels of every color and style, casual shoes, wooden bowls, and cooking utensils. Many of these items were stockpiled, sometimes for years, before they were used. His father was also a recreational shopper. He spent hours each Saturday shopping for tools and hardware. In most cases, these items were rarely, if ever, used. Clearly, Mr. Friend's parents were UAWs. He was well-trained. But today, he generates a much higher income than his parents ever earned. Why is he still a UAW? This income in itself is a result of parental guidance. His dad often told him to seek a job with high income potential. To do so would enable Mr. Friend to buy the finer things in life. His father's message was clear. To purchase a fine home, luxury automobiles, and expensive clothing, one has to earn a large income. Mr. Friend found that several areas of the sales profession had excellent income-producing opportunities. He would have to earn big to spend big. No mention was ever made of the value of putting money aside for investing. Income was designed to be spent. Credit was used heavily for major purchases. Mr. Friend and his parents have never appreciated the benefits of accumulating wealth via investing. Mr. Friend told us repeatedly that it's hopeless. He just does not have any money to invest. How is it that someone with an income 6 times the average for American households has no money to invest? Mr. Friend spends more annually for his children's private school and college tuition than the average household earns in a year. He has an inventory of automobiles that is valued in excess of $130,000. He pays more than $12,000 each year for property taxes. His total annual mortgage payments are in excess of $30,000. Several of his suits cost $1,200 each. But his insensitivity to the benefits of investing go beyond his need to consume. His parents had no understanding or appreciation of invested dollars. Nor does he. And his parents passed this lack of wisdom on to him. Mr. Friend argues that his parents were people of modest means, people with no money to invest. Let's examine this perception. His parents smoked 3 packs of cigarettes each day. How many packs did they consume during their adult lifetimes? There are 365 days in a year, so they consumed approximately 1,095 packs per year. They smoked for approximately 46 years. So in 46 years, they smoked 50,370 packs of cigarettes. How much did the couple pay for these cigarettes? Approximately $33,190, more than the purchase price of their home. They never considered how much it cost to purchase cigarettes. They viewed such purchases as small expenses. But small expenses become big expenses over time. Small amounts invested periodically also become large investments over time. What if the friends had invested their cigarette money in the stock market, such as an index fund, during their lifetimes? How much would it have been worth? Nearly $100,000. And what if they had used their cigarette money to purchase shares in a tobacco company? What if they had purchased, reinvested all dividends, and never sold shares in Philip Morris instead of smoking Philip Morris products for 46 years? At the end of 46 years, the couple would have had a tobacco portfolio worth over $2 million. But the couple, like their son, never imagined that small change could be transformed into significant wealth. This change in behavior alone would have placed the friends in the millionaire category. They would have been members of the PAW group, too, given their modest income. Perhaps they would have lived differently if someone had educated them about the mathematics of wealth appreciation. No one told them about this phenomenon. So it is not surprising that they failed to educate their son about the benefits of investing. But they did tell him not to smoke. His dad told him, "Don't ever put the first cigarette in your mouth. I'm hooked. There is nothing I can do to quit." His son followed this advice. Kicking the UAW habit. How long will Mr. Friend be able to fund his lifestyle? What if he were to stop working today? How long could he live off his current level of wealth? Only for about a year. No wonder he works so hard. Given his current circumstances, Mr. Friend will never be able to retire in comfort. In spite of being nearly 50 years of age, he has yet to figure this out for himself. But all is not hopeless. Mr. Friend can still become an accumulator of wealth. We find that it is often useful for UAWs to be told the naked truth. Friend, you're worth less than one half of the expected amount for those in your income/age group. Such news can spur on UAWs who are competitive. How do they respond when told that their net worth places them in the bottom quartile for all people with similar income and age characteristics? Some are incredulous. Many want to change but are uncertain how to transform themselves. How can someone change when they have more than 20 years' experience as a UAW? First, they must really want to change. Second, they will likely need some professional help. Ideally, they need to find a certified public accountant who provides financial planning. A professional of this type should have considerable experience and success with transforming UAWs. That is, they should have a strong track record in helping the Mr. Friends of the world become more PAW-like. In extreme cases, a CPA or financial planner actually takes control of his client's purchasing behavior. He first audits the client's consumption habits over the past 2 years. He categorizes and tabulates each element. Then the accountant consults with the client. The client is put into a cold turkey cutback program, meaning that all elements of consumption are reduced by a minimum of 15% for the next year or two. Additional cutbacks follow. In some situations, the accountant or financial planner even keeps his client's checkbooks, writes all the checks, and pays all the bills. Cold turkey is not easy for most UAWs, but sometimes it's the only way to solve the problem. The ultimate consumption category. The typical millionaire in our surveys has a total annual realized income of less than 7% of his wealth. This means that less than 7% of his wealth is subject to some form of income tax. In our latest study of millionaires, the percentage was found to be 6.7%. Millionaires know that the more they spend, the more income they must realize. The more they realize, the more they must allocate for income taxes. So millionaires and those who will likely become affluent in the future adhere to an important rule. To build wealth, minimize your realized income and maximize your unrealized income. Income tax is the single largest annual expenditure for most households. It is tax on income, not on wealth, and not on the appreciation of wealth if this appreciation is not realized. That is, if it does not generate a cash flow. What is the message? Even many high-income producing households are asset poor. One reason is that they maximize their realized incomes, often to support high-consumption lifestyles. Such people might wish to ask themselves a simple question. Could I live on the equivalent of 6.7% of my wealth? It takes much discipline to become affluent. We have interviewed many people worth $2 or $3 million who have total realized annual household incomes of less than $80,000. How much does the typical American household realize in income each year? About $35,000 to $40,000, or nearly the equivalent of 90% of its net worth. The result is that the typical household in America pays the equivalent of more than 10% of its wealth in income taxes each year. How about the millionaires whom we surveyed? On average, their annual income tax bill is an amount equal to only a bit over 2% of their wealth. That is one of the reasons they remain financially independent. Case study, Sharon and Barbara. Sharon is a high-income producing healthcare specialist. She recently asked us, "How is it that I make so much in terms of income but accumulate so little in terms of wealth?" Last year, Sharon's household had a realized total annual income of approximately $220,000, which places her household in the top 1% of all households in America. Sharon's household has a net worth of approximately $370,000. While Sharon's income is higher than 99% of the other households in America, her net worth is far below what it should be. Given her age, 51, and her income, $220,000, Sharon should, according to the wealth equation, expected net worth equals one-tenth of your age times your income, be worth approximately $1,122,000. Why is Sharon's level of accumulated wealth far below the norm? Because her realized or taxable income is too high. Last year, she paid $69,440 in federal tax on her $220,000 income. This is the equivalent of 18.8% of her total wealth. Yogi Berra might say, "Sharon, you can't be wealthy. Your income is too high." We believe that the average person in Sharon's income/age category pays the equivalent of only 6.2% of his wealth in annual federal tax, or $69,440 divided by $1,122,000. Thus, Sharon's tax equivalent, 18.8% of her wealth, is three times higher than the tax equivalent for the average person in her income/age category. To view this another way, Sharon has an annual realized income that is equivalent to 59.5% of her total net worth of $370,000. How could anyone hope to become truly wealthy when the equivalent of nearly 60% of her wealth is subject to income tax each year? The average person in Sharon's income/age category realizes the equivalent of only 19.6% of his net worth in annual income. Thus, only about $1 in $5 of his net worth is subject to income tax. What about people who have above-average levels of wealth? How much of their equivalent net worth is being taxed? Barbara is a typical member of the PAW category. Her realized annual income is approximately the same as Sharon's, $220,000. But Barbara's net worth is approximately $3,550,000. Therefore, the equivalent of only 6.2% of her wealth is subject to federal income tax. What percentage of Barbara's wealth is paid in federal income tax? Approximately 2%. In sharp contrast, Sharon paid the equivalent of 18.8% of her wealth in federal income tax, or more than nine times the percentage for Barbara. The average American millionaire realizes significantly less than 10% of his net worth in annual income. In spite of having considerable wealth and substantial annual increases in wealth in unrealized form, the typical American millionaire may personally be cash poor. More than 20% of Barbara's annual realized income is invested in financial assets that tend to appreciate in value without generating realized income. Sharon, on the other hand, invests less than 3% of her realized income. Most of her financial assets are in liquid form. Sharon's economic situation is quite risky. She is the main breadwinner in her household, which has little investment income. If her employer eliminates her job, what then? There are not too many positions available today that pay $200,000 or more a year. Barbara, again in contrast to Sharon, has a business with more than 1,600 customers. That's 1,600 sources of income. This is much less risky than Sharon's position. Sharon could not survive for 6 months if she lost her source of income. But Barbara could easily survive for 20 or more years. Actually, she could retire at this point on the income from her financial assets alone. Barbara, the prodigious accumulator of wealth,
is just one of more than 3.5 million millionaires in America today. More than 90% have a net worth between $1 and $10 million. How do these affluent people compare with the super affluent? Indications are that the higher one's net worth, the better one is at minimizing one's realized income. The fact is that the super affluent got to that position by being masters at minimizing their realized income. Ross Perot is the perfect example of how the super affluent stay affluent and even enhance their levels of wealth year after year. A Forbes article by Randall Lane called "What's Ross Perot Really Worth?" recently estimated that Mr. Perot's net worth was $2.4 billion. The Citizens for Tax Justice, a tax reform group headquartered in Washington, D.C., estimated that Perot's annual realized income in 1995 was approximately $230 million. Thus, he realized the equivalent of 9.6% of his wealth, but paid only $19.5 million in tax, or 8.5% of his income. See the January 1994 issue of Money magazine. Compare this figure with the 31.6% of their income paid in tax by Barbara, Sharon, and many others in their income category. How does Mr. Perot end up paying such a small percentage of his income in tax? According to a recent newspaper report by Tom Walker in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Perot minimizes his tax bill by investing heavily in tax-free municipals, tax-sheltered real estate, and stocks with unrealized gains. Of particular interest, Perot's tax rate as a percentage of his income, that is 8.5%, is lower than that of the average American household. The average household in this country pays $4,248 in federal income tax each year, or the equivalent of 12.9% of their annual realized income of $32,823. Perot is super affluent in terms of accumulated wealth, but he has less than the common man's marginal tax liability. Even more interesting than the percentage of income paid in taxes is the percentage of wealth paid in taxes. The typical American household has a total net worth, including equity in the home, of $36,623. They pay the equivalent of 11.6% of their net worth in income tax. What about Mr. Perot, the billionaire? In 1 year, it is estimated, he paid the equivalent of only 0.8% of his wealth in tax. In terms of income tax paid as a percentage of wealth, the typical household paid 14.5 times more. Most millionaires measure their success by their net worth, not by their realized income. For the purposes of wealth building, income doesn't matter that much. Once you're in a high income bracket, say $100,000 or $200,000 or more, it matters less how much more you make than what you do with what you already have. Working for the tax man. Assume for a few moments that you are Mr. Bob Stern, a scholar who works for the IRS. One morning, your manager, Mr. John Young, calls you into his office. He gives you an assignment to enhance his understanding of the relationship between income and wealth. John Young says, "Bob, I keep reading reports about the growth of the millionaire population." "Yes, I have a pile of articles and clippings on the same topic on my desk," Bob Stern responds. "Well, here's the problem. The number of wealthy people keeps rapidly increasing, but our income tax revenue for a lot of these people is not keeping pace. I read somewhere that the wealthiest 3.5% of the households in this country account for more than half of the personal wealth, but these same folks account for less than 30% of the income. I wish Congress would wake up. What this country needs is a tax on wealth. Even in biblical times, the rich had to pay 10% of their wealth each year in taxes. Now that's what I call the ultimate tax reform." "I know what you mean, but sooner or later we will get them. Remember, it's inevitable. Death and taxes." "The estate tax area is not your specialty, Bob. You are a little naive on this issue. You are thinking that we will eventually take a big bite out of all the millionaires in this country by taxing their estates. The Grim Reaper is on our side." "Not so fast, Bob. Just think of all the millionaires in this country. Most of them own some kind of a business, and a whole bunch own stocks. What do these folks do with their money? They sit on it. or they plow it back into their business. They hold on to all those stocks that keep appreciating. But what about the Grim Reaper? Look at it this way, Bob. We have often looked at estate returns in the $1 million and above level. Last year, there were only about 25,000. But, Bob, at the same time, there were 3.5 million millionaires alive and kicking. That means that 0.7% were picked up by the Reaper. This number should be twice as high. But you know what a lot of millionaires do? Before the Reaper shows up, they transform themselves. It's like magic. How do they do it? They can't just vanish. Do they move offshore before the Reaper shows up? Offshore is not a significant factor, but I would not be surprised if we found that half of the millionaires transform themselves into non-millionaires, BR. What do you mean by BR? It's an insider term. BR means before the Reaper, or prior to death, as opposed to AR, or after the Reaper. Look at this case study. Here's a woman, Lucy L., who had $7 million just a year before she died. She lived on her pension money, never in her life sold a share of stock out of her portfolio. Her wealth doubled in just the 6 years between her 70th and 76th birthdays. But what did we get out of it? In terms of income tax, nearly zip. She essentially had no realized income from her portfolio. I hate unrealized income. You're right, it is a clever enemy, but the Reaper, he got her, right? Death and taxes. Wrong, Bob. She died last year, and do you know what her net worth was at the time the Reaper finally showed up? Less than $200,000. No estate taxes. Another former millionaire moves on without leaving a taxable estate. Some days I wish I were in another line of work. The enemy is winning. But where did all her money go? She gave it to her church, two colleges, and a dozen or more charitable organizations. She also gave $10,000 to every one of her children, grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. She's real country, loaded with relatives, like a lot of mountain people. And what did we finally end up with? You're not listening, Bob. We, the government, got Zippo. Can you believe it? Her own government. There's no justice in America. We need a wealth tax. Well, she sounds like a pretty nice person to give so much money to a church, colleges, and charities. Bob, shame on you. She and her ilk are the enemy. America needs their wealth to keep our government operating. We need her money to pay off the federal debt. We need to fund all our social programs. Perhaps she feels that her church, the colleges, and the charities also have needs. Bob, you are so naive. This woman is an amateur. What type of experience does she have doling out her wealth? We are her government. We're experts in redistributing wealth. We should decide where and how wealth is distributed. We're the pros. We have to start taxing wealth before all the millionaires transform themselves into non-millionaires. What about all those famous people we read about in the newspapers, the ones who have very high incomes? God bless them, Bob. They are our best customers. I love people who are big earners. Realized income is our salvation. I want you to study these types. But I also want you to find out how these other types can exist without realizing a lot of income. Some of them must live like monks. What's wrong with these people? Why don't they sell a few $1 million worth of stock and buy a mansion? Is that why you have all those pictures of America's highest paid celebrities on the walls of your den at home? You bet. I love those people. They got a real bad case of the spends. And to spend, they have to have realized income. Look at it this way. When a ball player buys a $2 million boat, we become his partner. He will need to realize $4 million to pay $2 million for his boat. We are his partner. Ball players, are they good role models for our youth? Absolutely. They're high-income spenders. They tell our youth to earn and spend. It's realized income that our youth need to learn about. These spender types are true patriots. That's why I keep Webster's definition of patriot on my wall. Why don't you read it to me, Bob? Patriot. One who loves his country and zealously supports its authority and interests. Yes, Bob, zealously supports its authority and interests. You know, Bob, the real patriots out there are people who earn big incomes. $100,000, $200,000, and $1 million or more a year, and spend it all. Congress should mint a new medal for this type of patriotism, Bob. It would be called the Congressional Medal of Taxation and Consumption. And as long as these patriots keep training their kids to be medal winners, we are in good shape. Bob, you think we should start sending out holiday greeting cards to all those companies that promote luxury cars, yachts, million-dollar homes, and expensive clothes and accessories? These people are really patriots in their own way. They encourage spending. They are keeping us in business. Well, Bob, it's getting late. You have your assignment. I want to know more about the medal winners, but I also want you to study the ways of those who don't spend their money. What evidence is there that the government knows the formula for becoming financially independent in America? Just read some of the articles its employees have written recently. Many well-trained economists and other scholars who work for our government frequently conduct studies about the rich, or as they refer to them, the top wealth holders. We are particularly interested in the articles published in the Internal Revenue Service's Statistics of Income, a quarterly report. It's a research scholar's paradise, providing mountains of statistics on income. But income is not the government's only focus. It also studies top wealth holders. We are envious. We have to do our own surveys of the affluent. That's our main source for understanding the how-to-get-rich formula. C. Eugene Sterley is Assistant Director of the Office of Tax Analysis in the U.S. Department of the Treasury. He is also a scholar and a talented researcher. In the SOI Bulletin, he asks the same question we do. What is the relationship between realized income and wealth? What does he find? That people accumulate significant wealth by minimizing their realized/taxable income and maximizing their unrealized/non-taxable income. In the study that Mr. Sterley conducted, he compared the income tax returns the top wealth holders filed while they were alive with the estate returns their executors filed after the subjects passed away. He studied a national sample of estate tax returns. Then he matched each of these with their respective income tax returns from previous years. Why all this contrasting? Mr. Sterley wanted to study the correlation between realized income, as documented in income tax returns, and the actual net worth of each subject in the sample. Of special interest was the relationship between realized income generated from investments and their actual market value. Why would a scholar who works for our Treasury Department spend so much time conducting a study like this? We consider the staff of the IRS a clever bunch. They study their target market, and they lust for its wealth. They want to know how many affluent people generate so few dollars of realized income. Since owners of closely held businesses are especially adept at this strategy, Mr. Sterley selected for study those estates in which the value of the closely held businesses exceeded 65% of the estates. Here are some of the findings of Mr. Sterley's study. The income realized from the assets of closely held businesses was only 1.15% of the appraised value of the assets. Note that even this small percentage is likely to be biased in the upward direction, since there are estate tax advantages for heirs and executors who provide conservative appraisals. The total income realized from all assets and all salary, wages, and income combined was only 3.66% of the value of all assets. What do these results tell you about the affluent? They suggest that a business owner who is worth, say, $2 million on average, has an annual realized income of only $73,200, or 3.66% of $2 million. Could you live on $73,200 today and still invest a minimum of 15% each year? No, it's not easy. But it's not easy being financially dependent either. Financial independence. We once asked a high-income, low-net-worth corporate manager, we will refer to him as Mr. Rodney, a simple question. Why is it that you never participated in your corporation's tax-advantaged stock purchase plan? This manager's employer offered him a matching stock purchase plan. Each year, the manager could purchase the equivalent of 6% of his income in shares of the corporation, which would reduce his realized taxable income. Also, the corporation would match his purchase of company stock up to a certain percentage of his income. Mr. Rodney reported that, unfortunately, he could not afford to participate. It seemed that all his income went toward his $4,200 monthly mortgage payment, two leased vehicles, tuition bills, club dues, a vacation home that needed to be fixed up, and taxes. Ironically, Mr. Rodney wants eventually to become financially independent. But, like most UAWs, Mr. Rodney is not realistic in this regard. He has sold his financial independence. What if he had taken full advantage of the tax-advantaged benefit from the time he was first employed? Today, he would be a millionaire. Instead, he is on the perpetual earn-and-consume treadmill. We have interviewed countless high-income, low-net-worth people. Sometimes it can be depressing, especially when the respondents are seniors. How would you like to be a 67-year-old cardiologist who has no pension plan, never had a pension plan, in spite of earning millions during his lifetime? His total net worth is less than $300,000. No wonder he started asking us questions such as, "Will I ever be able to retire?" Even more revealing are the interviews we hold with the widows of UAWs. In many cases, the widow has been a housewife throughout her long marriage. Often her mate, a high-income, low-net-worth type, was underinsured or had no life insurance at all. "My husband always said not to worry about money. I'll always be here," he said. "Can you help me? What should I do?" This is not a fun situation. How can well-educated, high-income people be so naive about money? Because being a well-educated, high-income earner does not automatically translate into financial independence. It takes planning and sacrificing. What if your goal is to become financially independent? Your plan should be to sacrifice high consumption today for financial independence tomorrow. Every dollar you earn to spend is first discounted by the taxman. Earning $100,000 may be required to purchase a $68,000 boat, for example. Millionaires tend to think this way. That's why only a minority own boats. Do you plan to live on a boat after you retire? Or would you prefer to live on a $3 million pension plan? Can you do both? High-status neighborhoods. If you listened to the last section about the IRS's study of the affluent carefully, a question may have come to your mind. Are the results of the surveys we conducted different than those generated from income tax and estate tax returns? You will recall that on average, the millionaires in our latest survey had a total realized income that was about 6.7% of their total net worth. The results from the income tax and estate tax data, however, indicated that top wealth holders realized only 3.66% of their wealth. How can this difference be explained? And what does it mean? We employed a different sampling method than that used by the IRS in its study of income tax and estate tax returns. Our survey was based on sampling households that resided in high-status neighborhoods, whereas the IRS sampled from all income tax and estate tax returns. Since about half of the millionaires in America today do not live in so-called high-status neighborhoods, we also surveyed affluent farmers, auctioneers, and other wealthy people who live in non-status neighborhoods. Why do millionaires from high-status areas realize significantly more of their wealth, 6.7%, than those top wealth holders selected from a national sample of all affluent decedents, 3.66%? Because the millionaires from high-status neighborhoods have to realize more income to live in these areas. What are the implications of our findings? It's easier to accumulate wealth if you don't live in a high-status neighborhood. But even those millionaires who do live in high-status areas realize only 6.7% of their wealth each year. Think of their non-affluent neighbors who, on average, must constantly realize more than 40% of their wealth just for the joy of living in a high-status gulch. Perhaps you aren't as wealthy as you should be because you traded much of your current and future income just for the privilege of living in a home in a high-status neighborhood. So even if you're earning $100,000 a year, you're not becoming wealthy. What you probably don't know is that your neighbor in the $300,000 house next to yours bought his house only after he became wealthy. You bought yours in anticipation of becoming wealthy. That day may never come. Each year, you are forced to maximize realized income just to make ends meet. You can't afford to invest any money. Essentially, you're at a stalemate. Your high domestic overhead requires full commitment of all your income. You will never become financially independent without purchasing investments that appreciate without income realization. So what's it going to be? Will you choose a lifetime of high taxes and high status living, or will you change your address? Allow us to help you in your decision-making. Here is another one of our rules. If you're not yet wealthy, but want to be someday, never purchase a home that requires a mortgage that is more than twice your household's total annual realized income. Living in less costly areas can enable you to spend less and to invest more of your income. You will pay less for your home and correspondingly less for your property taxes. Your neighbors will be less likely to drive expensive motor vehicles. You will find it easier to keep up, even ahead of the Joneses, and still accumulate wealth.